The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Can I get you to state your name, your rank, and where you were from, please?
Yeah, I'm Ronald Henry Letch, L-E-T-C-H, born in Western Australia in 1926. I went to school in the Perth suburbs. As young boys, we were in the country in a place called Spencer's Brook, near Northam. Northam's a fair-sized town, you see, about 80 k's from Perth. We just had the average childhood sort of thing. Didn't know much about life in the bush because I was too young. You know, born there and left in January 1929, so I was only 3 years old, not quite 3 years old when I came down to the metropolitan area, where we remained for many years. But you'd get more information out of the book, actually.
Could I ask you to share some of your early childhood memories of moving to the city? Was it Perth that you moved to?
Yeah.
What were your first impressions of Perth?
We didn't see Perth at first. We came down to a suburb of Perth, South Perth, rented a house there, just as the Great Depression started, you see. But the federal and state governments had got together, and every state was involved, and it was called relief work. So the unemployed all got jobs. Infrastructure works. In the case of in Perth, my father was employed in making trenches, digging trenches with other men for deep sewerage, you see, because up to then it was just the old septic system, you know, septic tank in the backyard. But when we were there, the sewerage had advanced to a stage, you know, and Dad was working on that, digging trenches with his team of blokes by hand, although I think they had a big steam shovel to help them do that every part of the work. Dad broke a leg, we were off it, but it's all explained in there.
Was it a large family that you...
No. There were four boys only. My grandfather had three daughters and four sons. The daughters died. This was back in the 19th century, when kids popped off at a regular rate, you know, sort of thing. Alan, A-double-L-A-N, was the firstborn in 1921. Then John in 1923, or Jack his birth name was. He changed it later himself when he was during the Korean War. Then me, Ronald Henry. And then my young brother, Philip Henry, who had no military service because of his age. World War II was finished by the time he was of age, military age, you see.
Can I get you to talk a little bit about your military history?
I joined up, as I say, 11 days after D-Day, when I turned 18, you see. I've been in the kids... the Air Training Corps, the ATC they used to call it, which is for cadets. It's the same as Army cadets or somebody like this, or Navy cadets. They had a meeting once a week, and you went to camp at various Air Force bases over in Western Australia. You had an annual rifle shoots at Amberley, Melbourne, in South Australia, you know. That was my first bit of non-official military history, you know. But when I turned 18, I got the patriotic urge and joined up, as you can see there. So I can read a bit of it if you like.
Sure, so, yeah, terrific. That'd be wonderful, yeah. Thank you.
I first joined the RAAF 11 days after D-Day 1944. My intention was to serve Australia as an aircrew member, hopefully as a fighter pilot, because the newspapers and aviation magazines were publicising the exploits of these young heroes and the types of machines they flew. The records, however, also showed that these young men really lived between 19 to 25 years of age, and this was also the general case for the bomber crews. Fortunately for me and my longevity, my plans were frustrated by a series of interruptions during the initial training period. Although that first phase of training was eventually completed, and I had filled a number of useful but minor roles, I was demobilised from the RAF at war's end in March 1946. Many of us had great difficulty finding civilian employment. 3 months later, I enlisted in the Australian Army along with my brother Jack, who had previous Army service, and I built on the signals training which had begun in my first RAF period. Air Force training had been varied, including drill and ceremonial, had taught me about basic aerodynamics, navigation, meteorology, weapons and signalling, and guided my future choices when I later returned to the Air Force. And my 4 years of Army service had also brought me into contact with some interesting and amiable people. I mentioned a few people there. The RSM Regimental Sergeant Major at Balcombe Camp was Warrant Officer First Class James Eastlake, Jimmy the One they called him, who Jack got to know well, knew him better than me, and who had a fearsome reputation with recruits, although he had the affection and respect of the veterans among us who appreciated his sense of humour, his quirky antics. George Heinrich, who came from a South Australian farming family, had been an RAAF wireless air gunner during the war. I'm not sure what squadron he was in, and was now expert in the Army's communication systems, specialising at that time in the operating and servicing of lead acid battery rims. George told me about his experiences in the RAF and he gave me some great tips. Bertie Longston, a WO2, was a regimental quartermaster sergeant. Bertie had a motorcycle sidecar outfit which he liked riding at night around Mornington Peninsula. An affable man. I looked up the word afterwards, you know, after I wrote it down. Not sure I got the right word. An affable man. He took me on a nighttime spin once after the sergeant's mess bar had closed. We arrived back in one piece after some hairy riding to Hastings and back. Lieutenant Colin Catanac, Collier, it was his nickname, of course, was in charge of the instructional staff at Balcombe, and he had selected me from the lower ranks in Signals Training Battalion to join the Army School of Signals as a potential instructor. I was successful, so this helped me throughout my career, and I owed Col a debt of gratitude. After next serving at East Melbourne, the Army Education Service from 1948 as a librarian and film projectionist at Royal Park, which is near Melbourne Zoo, as a librarian and storeman, I transferred back to the RAF for aircrew training in late February 1950. The Air Force had advertised in the press 3 months earlier. At RAF Base Point Cook, I was now a trainee pilot/navigator. Jack remained with Army Signals and would serve with distinction in the Signals Corps for the rest of his regular Army career. Classroom instruction at Port Cook lasted for nearly 3 months. Then 50 of us did flight grading in Tiger Moth biplanes and yellow things, you know, to see who would be allowed to continue training as pilot. Out of the 50, only 25 were accepted. I came 26th, inevitable, you know, so missed out by one place. But this didn't deter me. I opted to continue training as an air signaller because of previous signalling training experience, you see, and not as a navigator. This option was approved, and a year later I qualified as an RAAF signaller gunner at East Sale. I encountered many of my fellow trainees from Point Cook later in various roles, but sadly one of them died in a crash with his instructor during the pilot course. A few reached five more of them lost their lives in the Korean War, more died in air accidents and so on. But after that, as I say, I did my signal of training, qualified with no trouble, and I was posted to transport aircraft at Richmond, New South Wales, in late 1951. Did an air dispatch course at Williamtown, the Army was running that. We were four aircrew involved, a photo in the back there. And so we flew around Australia in the old DC-3s from Richmond for the first couple of years. The Korean War was on at the time, and the Malayan merger, Malayan emergency too. So eventually I was posted to Iwakuni, RAF Iwakuni, number 30 transport unit, to fly operationals, flying in DC-3, which weren't a particularly ferocious aeroplane as far as attacking other targets went. Our main role was just carry gear over to the different British Commonwealth units in the Korean service, in the Korean War, you see, and evacuating wounded back to Japan. Apparently, there were about 12,000 Commonwealth wounded to carry back to Iwakuni. I wasn't involved in that many of them, four or five trips, but some of them had missing legs and arms and things like that, and frostbite, you know.
Are these images very vivid today still from all these years ago?
Yeah, well, there are photographs in there of us loading troops onto the aircraft and that, you know, in this book, which I just skipped over in this one. But I marked this one classified, you see, not for publication. It doesn't matter much, but I use actual names for authenticity, you see.
Yep. Yeah.
It's the first trip up to Japan, Iwo Jima and places like that, which was a bit hard to find in a DC-3. That one of my skippers, who I flew with most of the time, was Gordon Stewart. And there's an account there of one of his little escapades one day. It's just down there, you see.
Would you mind, could I get you to read this story?
Yeah. I was on several. We did a lot of R&R work to carrying troops from Korea to Japan for their, you know, holidays, breaks, rest and recuperation. On one trip, as we watched the MATS was Military Air Transport Service, United States Air Force Reservists flew those planes, C-54 SkyMart four-engine Douglas. On one trip, as we watched a MATS C-54 Skymaster wrote off its undercarriage on the seawall while landing at Haneda, Tokyo. But everybody escaped unhurt. They just jumped out of the bloody thing. Because those aircraft didn't burst into flames those days when they crashed, because they had different sort of tanks in the wings, you know. Later on, as I'll explain later, we lost one of our Orions when we were picking them up from Lockheed, you know, because one of its undercarriage legs collapsed, which allowed the wing to touch the ground, you see, touch the runway, and it burst into flames. And it had a crew on board, and they all managed to escape through one of the escape hatches, you see, without nobody was hurt. That was just it. Anyway, Stewie was my pilot on DC-3s in Korea. After 5:30 a.m. one morning, Stewie had not turned up for a 6 a.m. takeoff. I was driven in the squadron's jeep to the officer's quarters and located his room. Loud snoring and the alcohol smoky fumes issued forth. I roused our skipper and asked if he wanted a replacement pilot. She'll be right, just hang on a tick, says Stewie. He smoothed out the flying suit he had slept in, washed his face and pulled on his flying boots. Back on the tarmac, our co-pilot had completed his pre-flight inspection, informed Stewie, and remarked to me, the captain was drunk. I assured him that was the night before, and he was now mostly sober. Not satisfied, Murray Kay, the co-pilot, boarded the Dakota and sat in the left-hand seat, on the captain's throne! Exclamation mark. He was physically removed, lifted over the centre controls, dumped in the right-hand seat and told to bloody well stay there. Quite a physical feat. Of course, that took the wind out of Stewie. But he started start-up taxiing and take-off were expertly handled, and Stewie turned the Dakota left, because it's a north-south runway, you see. I'm heading north. Left onto a course set in the general direction of Korea. I stood between the two pilots, as you can there. You see the space there. There's Stewie sitting there. The co-pilot's there, but this photo wasn't taken on that day, you see. I stood between the two pilots, Murray staring grimly out of the right window, possibly praying for a painless death, you know. But Stewie had levelled out at circuit height. This wasn't right. Looking ahead, the range of hills west of the airfield was getting closer, and Stewie was dozing. He actually dropped off to sleep again, you know. I suppose his effort lifting him over the centre console. I shook his shoulder firmly, pointed ahead and said loudly, Stewie, fucking hells. Power was increased, in brackets, through automatic reflex action. The nose was raised and Stewie's hangover was miraculously cured. After 2 hours, he landed us safely at Seoul. He let Morrie fly the duck back to Iwakuni. From that day, I appointed myself, in brackets, unofficial, safety monitor of every crew I flew with. I checked that the bastards weren't doing the wrong thing, you know. I appointed myself unofficial safety monitor of every crew I flew with. I saw Morrie, the co-pilot, 20 years later at Perth Airport. He was an ANZUS pilot. In brackets, I don't believe Morrie had reported the incident in 1952. One day we had a navigator had twined around here, a piece of cloth, and he made a skull and crossbone. We stuck it up through the Veery pistol hole that they got in the roof of the Dakota. And the Seoul air traffic controller, who was, they're all Yanks, you know, they were operating the system. Report to the air traffic, you know, after you get out, because there's nothing. They weren't too happy. The Yanks had their way of doing things and they liked to do it their way, you know. So they were very friendly. The Yanks helped us quite a bit. They, particularly their ground mechanics, you know, the engine fitters and people like that. If anything went wrong with our DC-3, they knew DC-3s backwards, you see, because they'd been flying them longer than we had. And they were very good. One of our VHF sets bloke down, approaching Seoul one day, and we had no ground crew in Seoul, you know. So we just used to rely on their maintenance people. And so they fixed it, swapped it for one of theirs. And I said, can't you fix ours? Because our equipment people are very fussy about identification plates on pieces of equipment. You had to have the right serial number stamped on it. No bloody trouble, he said. So he just undrilled the plate, put the same plate on the new set that he puts in, you see. So legally it's okay. It's the same piece of equipment. There was another thing that they did. We never had to use it, but there was a lot of ice and snow up there, you know, in the winter time. And if the battery was down a bit and you couldn't start your left engine, which you had to do before you started the right engine to get enough electricity, you see, to run the starter motors, they used to put a rope around the propeller boss, attach the other end to the Jeep, and switch the ignition on and say, ready, set the throttles at the right opening, drive the Jeep away and turn the old props around and start the engines that way. Not officially improved, but it worked.
It definitely worked.
Eh?
It definitely worked.
Oh, yeah, they used to use it, do it. And I write in here that one of the things you can do when you're doing a pre-flight is, in cold climate, was to hose the wings down. Because water, if it's flowing through a pipe, has got to be warmer than ice, you see. So, I believe they did that in the Antarctic flight when they were down there. We never used it because the Dakotas have got that leading edge de-icing boots. When they switch them on, there's just an air pump, pumps air into them so they can inflate and deflate them as they go, and it breaks all the ice off the leading edge of the wing. It just gets blown away in the slipstream, you see. So it's pretty good, pretty well equipped for a primitive old aircraft, you know.
Dave, there's a big wingspan, isn't it?
Yeah, 100 foot wingspan or 99 or something like that. People remarked on that, but it was right for the construction of the damn things. The outer wings were bolted on with, I'm not sure how many, they should say how many bolts there were, around the flange between the outer wing and the inner wing, you know. Instead of having, in some aircraft, they have a big spar go straight through, you know. And these they were a bit differently designed and built. They were all box sections inside the wing. But it worked because I got a photo, another photo, not in the book, of a whole squadron of people standing on the wings of these things. Ground crew and air crew, the whole squadron, you know, standing up on the wings. So they didn't snap off.
And how did they handle, how did they fly? Were they...
Beautifully. Slow.
Heavy and slow, or...?
No. Weight and balance was important, and that was all ever calculated before we... It's part of the pre-flight, you know.
This is the Richmond base where you did your training?
That's, as I say there, on the side. I took that from one of the observation windows towards the back of the Neptune. As I just flying there, I flew on circuits one day because I used to always have a camera with me. You see the beautiful lake we had, a boomerang-shaped lake with a family of black swans and their cygnets there. Just, you know, a sports ground there, tennis courts there, more tennis courts up there, swimming pool there. That's the main mess building. It curves around in an arc sort of thing. Built in the 1930s. Wood panelling, beautiful wood panelling of different Australian woods, parquetry flooring. And us reprobates used to sleep in this place here. It was called the West Wing of the... the East Wing. Yeah, the East Wing, that's right. Because north's that way. And there's a main mess building there, sort of a inverted V part of it there. And these married quarters all up around.
So how many personnel would be here
at Richmond?
Given time?
Oh, 3,000 to 4,000, I suppose. But that's only the outer part of it. That's the base headquarters there. Bullshit Castle, we called it, naturally, you know. That's the RAF Hospital, and that's some of the wards there. The powerhouse. The WAFI's quarters. They had three of those two-storey buildings there. And they had balconies outside each room. Actually, you got a corridor down the middle. And we had another two across the back and three down this side, which were NCO quarters, you know, sergeants, flight sergeants, and so forth. I think when I first went there, I used to sleep in this building, and this was the sergeants' mess, and that was our bar, billiard room, etc., etc., where I managed to set fire to a tent they had outside, a marquee, had up for some function, and they'd decorate it with crepe paper and lights and stuff like that, and I had a refreshment light and put a cigarette onto the paper and set fire to it, you see. It's a bit of a hullabaloo, but I didn't get any punishment. I just said, you know, how careless. Like the old bloke helped me carry a piano upstairs, and the bloke in front went too fast. The piano dropped on his foot, and the old cartoon said, bloke screaming, yours. Red head, red face and everything, he's screaming, how clumsy of you, Albert. Instead of shit fuck, you know. You stupid bastard. No. Things go on. Yeah, I never got married. And I've got an explanation in here, a sort of thing. But they just kept me too busy. Difficulty is I had these different postings. I'd started off on transport aircraft, went through the Korean War, came back from that, straight onto Neptunes, just after they'd got the Neptunes. I was in that for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, and then they posted me to Ballarat as an instructor, because I'd done that instruction course in the Army, you see, as an instructor for the trainee signallers.
That was Ballarat,
both in the classroom and flying, you see, as flying instructors. I was a warrant officer then. I stayed a warrant officer for 9 years. They attempted to promote me twice, and I kept rejecting the offer, you know, until finally they taught me into it, and I became a flying officer, and then a couple of years later, a flight lieutenant, you see, which is the rank I retired with. And when I finished that, I flew on a grasshopper camp plane, New South Wales, Victoria, grasshopper plague in 1956, late 56, I think it was. And then they posted me to the UK on exchange postings with RAF Transport Command for 2.5 years. And I was still a warrant officer, and it wasn't usual to post non-commissioned officers over there for the exchange. The reason was that I had a mate in Korea who got killed in a car crash in England while he was with the Transport Command. And they needed somebody urgently to take his place, so they sent me to England to do the job. And we flew all over the place, all over the world, you know, South America, Pacific, all through Africa, with the palms, you know, flying the aircraft. We were an Australian skipper most of the time. He's dead now. Most of them are, you know.
Did you keep in touch with a lot of your pals over the years?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was at Queen's Coronation. One of my mates, a navigator, a little the worse for demon drink, was watching a US sailor who was likewise affected and who was blatantly ogling someone else's woman. They're all Yanks in the place, you see. This lady, whose feet were killing her, had just removed her shoes and at an opportune moment when neither were watching, my young friend with malice aforethought emptied his glass into one of the shoes. A few moments later, being aware of the ogler's attentions, the lady decided to replace the footwear and on experiencing the cold, dank contents, reacted angrily, declaring, "You son of a bitch, you poor bear in my shoe." "Madam," retorted the aggrieved sailor man, "I wouldn't piss in your goddamn shoe." A brief but fiery confrontation with the lady's partner ensued, and the combatants were escorted from the premises. The remainder of the evening proceeded without further misdemeanors. My navigator acquaintance, Fitz, exhibiting no shame or remorse whatever, the accession of QE2 had been suitably celebrated. And that's what the mess, the sergeant's mess at Iwakuni in Japan, decorated for the occasion. There's red and white, specially grown roses all around the top of the bar there, and it's explained there. These red, white and blue stream of things there with the picture of the crown on top, you know. The Japanese were very good to us there, you know.
1953?
Yeah, that's when the coronation. Back in Australia, the year before that, all aircraft had to land at the nearest airport to respect King George VI's funeral, you know. And this is the following year. That's Red Connolly.
That's you there?
Yeah, look, a bit pissed there, I'd say. No, they're good blokes.
Doug Tobin, John Williams and Ron Letch.
Yeah, there were more there. The place was full, you know. I didn't take that picture there. I took that one. There's a privateer, four-engine things. Yanks flew them. I didn't have many.
So what was your favourite plane out of all of the ones?
Oh, I don't
know. Did you have a favourite?
Well, the old Decatur, of course, and the Neptunes. And then we flew the Orions. If you know the Orions, they retired them from 10 and 11 squadrons in 2018, just under 2 years ago. And they'd had them 50 years since I went over with the squadron and brought back the first Orions, the P-3Bs they called them. I didn't like the Orions quite so much. They were very complicated aircraft, very expensive, but I managed to burn one on the runway in America.
What happened?
Oh, it was a landing accident. The landing was perfect, but there was the aircraft itself. I say here, the following two pages are rather detailed and technical, but I feel that's necessary so as to give a real idea of the operations I became involved in, as asked by family members. So not to disappoint my dear ones, the bastards, no, my dear ones, and hopefully not bore you too much, prepare yourselves for some knowledge and practices that were essential for doing the job, and be prepared to be a little bit bored for a page or two, you see. And that's about all it takes. And then I go straight on to flying and that. And what happened, you see? British Atomic Test in the Monte Bello Islands. And
when was the last time you flew?
I used to fly from here to Perth quite a bit when my relations over there got sick, very sick, you know. But no, in the Air Force, the last 2.5 years, I was flying on Orions, and I'd only done about 1,000 hours on Orions, and they posted me over to Pierce, Western Australia, No. 2 pilot training school, you see, flying training school, as an instructor in the pilot's course. Three pilot's course, 74, 75 and 76 courses. And my best student was Angus Houston. You've heard of Angus? They made him Sir Angus in the end. First of all, he rose to the rank. He was a POM. He came out from England because the RAF wouldn't accept him for pilot training because he was too tall. One of the nicest blokes you'd ever meet. And they all loved him in the Air Force when he became a senior officer, you know. Angus Houston was, he contradicted John Howard when Howard, or one of his ministers, accused him of throwing people into the ocean up north, you know. And Angus said, it never happened. I was there, and that not didn't happen. And he was telling the truth. When it came over on the television, I said, my sister-in-law was in the room with me watching TV, and I said, that's Angus. I said, I knew him. He was my best student at Pierce. And he'd never known him to tell a mistruth or to exaggerate anything, you know. Anyway, Julia Gillard nominated him and had a big party. Both political sides were in the party on his retirement from the Air Force, you know, because they made him Chief of the Air Force. And he became, another year or two later, Chief of all Australian Armed Forces before he eventually retired, you see. And the last thing that they gave, the job that they gave him was MH17 investigation, you know. No, not MH17. The one that got lost in the Indian Ocean. They investigated that. And they still haven't found the wreckage or anything like that yet. Not likely to. Yeah. They posted me from one thing to another, so I never had time to rest, you know. And they said, well, why didn't you get married? Because I didn't, you know. Eventually. We were in Japan, we were in the Philippines, and there were some very pretty ladies there. Might have had a night or two, you know, and that's about it, you know. I never got really involved with a dinky die Aussie girl because they just kept me going, you know. They said, do something, go somewhere, have parties and that. And most of our parties were family ones or mess ones. In the sergeant's mess, the officer's mess, I had two steel pant stanchions, I suppose you'd call them, in the old sergeant's mess at Richmond, coming down from the ceiling. Two or three of them, and they had one of those cast iron fires in the middle of the room, you know, took briquettes for heat. And the folks would get a bit of pissing on them, and they'd jump up to the top of these bloody stanchions, grab them and spin around them, see who could get the most spins, most turns before reaching the ground, you see, things like that.
Wow. So you've just really, over decades, you've been just constantly on the move.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that should tell you pretty well. And I've got friends here in South Australia.
Is your service number in here somewhere?
No.
Do you know your service number off?
Yeah.
Yeah, can I just...
I started off, when I first joined the RAF, it was 442240. That's a wartime number for the Empire Air Training Scheme, you see. That was air crew trainees numbers. And then later on, when I came back into the Air Force, it was A51084.
51084.
Yeah. And when I got commissioned, it became O51084. It was on blue paper. Department of Air, you see there. And he was, that's his particular, secret commander of the Bath, all that sort of rubbish. It's just a thank you for my service, you see. And since I was a good bloke and that sort of thing, I agree with him. And the troops never had any trouble with me. I never put anybody on a fizzer because they never fizzed, you know. That's not been published. Neither of those have been published, of course. I just produce enough copies that for one for each family member, you see.
My godfather, his name is Ron Bone, from Tanunda here. He flew the Sunderlands.
Oh, yeah.
They were the water planes, weren't they?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
They did the Atlantic Ocean. They helped clear the Atlantic Ocean of U-boats. And do you know where Colin Grant was a tail gunner in Sunderlands. And their squadron sank 6 U-boats, mainly in around the Bay of Biscay or something like that.
And do you look through these often? Do you look through these books often? And
oh, yeah, when I'm trying to think of something, you know, and see some people there. I think That was on the beach at Pyongyangdo. We had to go in there. It's in North Korean island. It was right on the 38th parallel, which was a different point, and that was our aircraft, A6593, that's that aircraft. So I had to take two photographs of this because I didn't have a wide-angle lens, you know, so I took one and I just merged them all together in my word processor, you know, so that not in the photo because I was at the other end of the camera, you see, looking through the eyepiece. And I never got that fellow's name. He was the engineer in charge of the team that actually put the engine into the Meteor jet, you see. The Meteor had done a forced landing there, lost one of its two engines, and we had to take an engine from Japan over to this island, land there on the beach, which is there, and leave the servicing crew and its portable crane and tools on the island, waved them goodbye, went back to Seoul, and then took some more passengers back to Japan, you see. Somebody else came and picked them up afterwards. So you had to admire our ground crew. They were very devoted.
Thank you, Ron, very much for sharing those stories.
You're welcome.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.